Welcome to the United Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Smith. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. If you could do me a quick favor, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, could you please take 10 seconds to leave us a five-star review and a comment about the speaker that you like the most? I love having speakers on here twice, so your feedback definitely lets me decide on who to invite on the show. I want to thank our good friends at Dr. Dish. Dr. Dish has been a loyal supporter since the very beginning with the podcast and the coaching clinics. Follow them on social media. They put awesome stuff out there all the time on Instagram and Twitter at Dr. Dish B-Ball on all social media. Also, coaches, check out UnitedBasketballPlus.com. It's the newest resource we have. Use the promo code UBPLUS, that's capital U, capital B, plus, and receive 10% off for an annual membership between now and April 15th. Coaches, enjoy the podcast. Guys, I want to welcome a friend of mine and someone I respect in the business a lot, Coach Burton Uwaro at Bob Jones in Greenville, South Carolina. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us after you've had a busy week and a great last couple of weeks with the region tournament and your national tournament in your league. Talk a little bit about that.
We were very fortunate. We lost a couple people to injuries and other things this year and to COVID, and we were able to go on a nice run in 2022, and we ended up with the second best record in Bruin history, and having 16 wins is pretty big at our level. With, you know, we play four D1s this year. We usually have a pretty tough schedule against scholarship schools, and we were fortunate enough to win our region championship. And then we just competed in the national tournament out of Missouri and just got back Sunday night. So I'm already missing the routine of it. I'm already missing practice. I don't know what that says. That may be a long off season for me, but maybe this podcast will scratch that itch a little bit.
Yeah, I hope so. And yeah, it's always when you have a good team, you enjoy being with the guys and your staff and good chemistry and culture. Man, those first couple of days without going to the gym and putting time on the clock and rolling out the balls, it's like, well, it's nice to have some free time, but I kind of rather be in the gym.
That's right. That's right.
Well, listeners, we're going to talk about something we haven't really dove into on the podcast much. We've talked a little bit about analytics, but we're going to talk about the four factors. And Coach Uwaro does a great job implementing these in practice. And he's going to talk about how he focuses on these four factors. And we're going to talk about those. So I know a lot of coaches today are really analytically based and pay attention to a lot of things. So talk about your background a little bit. And when did these really start becoming important to you and you started paying attention to the four factors? And we'll also talk about those individually as well.
Well, they really started becoming important to me when we first crossed each other's paths when I was at Creekside Christian Academy in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And when I was a high school coach. But as a high school coach, you don't have a whole lot of time. You usually don't have a whole lot of help. And so I tried to focus on what I could, but I wasn't able to track them as effectively. And if high school coaches now subscribe to Huddle breaks these things down for you. And you can always know how you scored and how your opponent scored in the four factors. And so I would say the growth of Huddle, being able to use Synergy at the college level, we use both of those. Huddle tracks what we do even in our practices with their camera. And so we're able to, every practice that we have that's on our main court, we're able to stat it and know the four factors from that practice. And so it becomes a thing that we talk about all the time. Sometimes people wonder what we talk about in timeouts, what we talk about at halftime. And I think focusing on these things, these are the people say to focus on the process. Well, this is the process. And it takes a lot of the emotion out of it. You may have a game where things are going really well or things are not going well. And if you just take it back to what factors into winning with these four factors, I think that helps us not go in at halftime and make something personal with somebody. We've all made mistakes at halftime and after a game of letting emotion rule. And I believe that focus on these things just helps us kind of take the personality out of it and focus on what really matters.
Yeah, and the four factors listeners were talking about are effective field goal percentage, known as e-field goal percentage, turnover percentage, offensive rebounding percentage, and your free throw factor, you know, free throw percentage, made shots over free throw attempts. So coach, let's talk about these a little individually. And effective field goal percentage is something I think a lot of coaches pay attention to. Again, if you're on Huddle like I am, Huddle Assist especially, little non-sponsored plug for Huddle Assist there. You know, it's something to really pay attention to with your lineups on the floor and something you can talk about with your players. But talk about e-field goal percentage and how you talk about that with your players, what you're looking for specifically, and how it influences, you know, what lineups you have on the floor possibly at certain times of the game.
Well, yeah, I've talked about this a lot. I'm trying to think of the best way to talk about it on a podcast where people can't see graphics and all of that. Really what we're looking for offensively is the highest percentage shots are generally, for the most part, I don't think anything was ever 100% true, but for the most part, getting to the basket and getting fouled is one way we can get 3 points, or getting to the basket, and then kicking out. You know, inside out basketball has almost always been true since the days of George Mikan and then Bill Russell, all of that. If you can get in, get the defense to collapse and then contract back out, people have called that different things, but you're basically creating a lot of closeouts, which I think is probably the most difficult thing to do in basketball, is to close out effectively, especially with the line moving even further back this year. And so we designed our offense to be the most efficient that it could possibly be. And when you design it that way, we designed our offense based on the four factors. And so that leads our skill development, that leads our lineups. You know, another non-sponsor addendum here is we use Dr. Dish a lot. We use the latest Dr. Dish, where we're able to program a lot of workouts into it. They're able to pull it up on their phone, the workout. We're able to see on our phone what they did, how well they shot. We get a shot chart on our phone from all that. And so all of those things lead to us being more competitive. And so really we try to recruit everybody. We have a 7-footer right now, and our 7-footer is one of the best 3-point shooters on our team. And so, you know, at our level, we try to recruit to what we're going to be able to get every year. And we should always be able to get some pretty good guards, and then some pretty versatile guys who are like 6'6", 6'7". That's where we feel comfortable playing. And it used to be called European basketball, but I think it's just globally what people are doing right now.
Right. Yeah. Our kids love the Dr. Dish as well, and how you can link it to your phone. And it's been a great addition to our program. So, and again, guys listening, I'm going to put a link to an article on the four factors in the podcast notes. You can look at that if you want to. So on the e-field goal percentage, is there a certain percentage you look for for like a guard or just overall team? How do you analyze this when you're communicating with your players, or what goals are you trying to reach? And is there a certain number of 3-point attempts that you would like to shoot per game?
We don't look at 3-point attempts. One of the ways we have found for us that gets us our highest field goal percentage, which we want, I could go off on a tangent here. If you're familiar with being a 180 shooter, I can break that down a little bit later, but we focus on being a 180 shooter. And when we do that, one of the best ways to do that is for the ball to touch three sides. And so we ball reversals as a way for us to get effective field goal percentage. We do want our effective field goal percentage to be at 40%. We don't have a goal of how many 3-point attempts we take as a team. We have key guys based on our shooting stats, based on stats that we get from our Dr. Dish. We know who we can trust and where they shoot best from, based on a lot of data. And so we're able to get those guys the most shots, and your players see all that same information too. And so there really hasn't been any, I don't think, jealousy or trying not to share the ball with some of those guys. The players are really pretty clear on who should be taking those shots and who should be getting the most shots. They all have the freedom if they take the shots within the context of our offense. And so if the ball has touched three sides or if it comes off of a paint touch, that's where they're able to take those threes. And so to get a little bit geeky with you, when I've talked with you before in a previous podcast, we use similar offense, a dribble drive type offense, and based on concepts. And one of the concepts is not to get two drives in a row. If you drive twice in a row, you haven't made the defense moving up. And so if you're trying to get triple gaps and create that much spacing, you can't do that with two consecutive drives. And so we try to get one drive, into the paint, followed by a skip pass. And that usually leads to a really good shot for us.
So we can pause here for a second. If you want to go ahead and dive into the 180, which you were talking about a couple of minutes ago, feel free to hit that now and explain that to the listener.
All right. So 180 shooter is, if you add it up, you're 90% from the free throw line, 50% from the field, and 40% from the three-point line. And I got that from Brian McCormick. I'm sure you and most of your listeners are probably familiar with him. I had him speak at our clinic last year. He wrote a book called The 180 Shooter, and he wrote it a while ago. I've heard people talk about it more this year than the year that it came out, which was probably, I bet that book is probably 10 or 12 years old, but a lot of what Brian McCormick does is way ahead of the curve. And so if you're going to be 90% from the free throw line, 50% from the field, and 40% from the three-point line, then your workouts need to look like that. Your practice needs to look like that. And so, again, I don't want to get too far off into that, but that is one of the things that we look at in trying to have effective field goal percentage.
So how many 180 shooters did you have? I mean, that's a pretty high goal, 90% from the line, 40% from three, 50%. And I would think at a high school level, I would drop that down a little. So, you could probably have a 130, 135 shooter for sure.
Right. So I had two guys, my two best players. They were first team all region. One was all region player of the year, and made the All-American team. Those two guys were super, super close. I haven't added up all of the season stats yet since we got back from our national tournament. So I'm not sure 100% how they finished off, but they've been really, really close to that the entire year. One is above a 90% free throw shooter, but the other's like at 85%. Three-point shooting, they're really close to 40% most days. And so this year is actually the year that I've had the most people closest to that. And we have a number of guys who are there at certain times, but then there's other weeks where they're not. And I feel like they just haven't had enough reps yet.
Right.
Maybe they've come from a high school or something like that's not really emphasized. And so they'll get there. They're just not there yet.
Yeah, I was running some numbers right here on my calculator. If a high school player, let's say a high school free throw percentage was 75%, but let's go 80%. They shot 40% from the free throw line and 45% from the field. I did my math wrong there. Calculator. So 75 plus 40 plus 50, maybe 165. And that's not bad. I don't know if I've ever had too many 40% three-point shooters at high school level. So for me, a great number just personally is, if I have a 37%, right. I mean, if you shoot 37%, I feel like that's really good at the high school level, especially if you're talking like a 16-year-old. But yeah, I think coaches can take this and although 180 is tough, but give a reasonable goal. And I like how you broke that down. You may be 180 this day at practice, this week at practice, or this one game.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, and then just keep shooting for a high goal like that. And I think that's important for guys and how you, again, track stats where the whole team can see them. You openly communicate it. And are you kind of like what Mike Neighbors does? Do you call like kids like you're a green light shooter or you have your own terminology?
That was going to be my next thing. We have done that in the past and transitioning to D3, we're not allowed to be with them as often as we were able to be in the past. We can't be with them until October 15th. And then as soon as the season ends, We can't be with them again to practice. And so, you know, some of those things that we used to do a lot in preseason before October 15th, they kind of do on their own. And so I would say we still do that, but we don't do that in the same fashion. I was all sold out. I got that from Coach Neighbors probably.
It's time consuming.
Before he was even at Arkansas.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's since put out a good video about it. He has good PDFs about it. He's got some stuff on YouTube about it as well. I would encourage people to look at that. But that is the idea. When the guys know, the guys who are 180 shooters, they basically know that those guys are greenlit and they deserve the touches. And that is where the ball will go at the end of the game. No matter what we draw up, those guys will end up with the ball.
Yeah, no, that's really good. Again, I love what Neighbors does, and he's spoken at clinics with me for me in the past in Indiana. But you're right, some of the stuff he does is so time consuming. So if you're at your level where you can't be with the kids in the preseason, like the D1 coaches or even high school coaches, various states have various limitations, but you can tweak that. And like, again, Dr. Dish does sponsor the show, so I will plug them a million times. But when you have their machine or two of their machines, it takes care of a lot of this stuff for you.
Right. And we do have partner shooting. We have partner shooting every day in practice. And so a lot of the drills that Mike Neighbors uses to chart that becomes our partner shooting drills. We spend at least 20 minutes a day, usually 30 minutes a day, the entire year in practice. They have to get 500 shots outside of practice, but in practice they have about usually 20 to 30 minutes. And we use all those green light shooting drills.
And that's 500 shots in a week outside of practice in the week, or is that
500 shots a day?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so if you're going to have effective field goal percentage at a college level, you've really got to do the work. And the guys who do the work, there is no magic to it. Like Nick Saban says, it takes what it takes. And for everybody who's done that in our program, they have seen the benefits. There's nobody that's done it that's regretted doing that. And they will see the fruits of their labor.
Anything you want to add or say about e-field goal percentage before we move on to turnover percentage? Any other thoughts you were having or stats?
I would just say if people are new to the whole four factors concept, you know, it is not 25% of each thing. What weighs the most out of the four factors is your e-field goal percentage. The next highest thing that is important for you to stat is your turnover rate per 100 possessions. Then your offensive rebound rate, and then your free throw rate. Your offensive rebound rate's 20, your free throw rate's 15%. And, you know, all of us, we would not say out of the four factors, we would not like that's only worth 15% of it. But if you think about how many you take, there may be some games where you take a ton, but then there's some games where you don't. And so that's the reason why that does not weigh as much as something else. And so in an ideal world, your field goal percentage is the thing that you're best at, but there are going to be nights where that isn't the case, where you're going to have an off shooting night. And so if you're not doing really well in that category, which is the biggest category, then of course your turnovers better be low, your offensive rebounds better be high. And so it is okay that some of these factors take a bigger precedence throughout the year. It's good after 10 games, you can probably see what your trend is. If you haven't done this before, I would do it in summer league basketball. I would try to chart what I can and just look at some trends. And that really helps us plan out what we do in the off season, what we do the next season. And really, when we set out our season schedule, even to our player evaluations at the end of the year, it's all directly related to the four factors in one way or another.
So, again, I know high school coaches are listening. They're like, oh, my gosh, turnover percentage keeps people up at night. What is a good – turnover percentage, like when at the end of a game and you look at your stats, what is a number you want to be below?
United Basketball Plus is your doorway to all things basketball. If you desire to go further, faster as a coach and leader, if you want to maximize your team's potential, or if you simply just want to be a student of basketball, United Basketball Plus is the resource to take you to the next level in your basketball journey. As a member, you will have access to some of the greatest minds in basketball today. The in-depth videos provided by these coaches and basketball experts will help make difficult concepts simple to understand and teach. With your membership, you will have access to video playbooks, sports psychology, fast model playbooks, skill development, speed agility, and various other United Basketball Clinic videos. Your annual membership also includes access to our 2021 United Basketball Clinics, as well as discounts to attend future basketball clinics. The best way to find out all we have to offer is to visit us at unitedbasketballplus.com.
Well, I want to be, you know, at a college game being longer. Obviously, like I said, we play a lot of D1s and D2s. We play a lot of NIIs. We play a lot of people that are what you would consider to be above our level. And so there's going to be a lot of games where we have a lot higher turnovers than what I'm comfortable with. But at our level, I would like us to be in single digits. And, you know, we play pretty fast. We try to be shooting. We try to cross half court within 5 seconds, and we try to be into our offense, you know, in the first 8 seconds. And so when you do that, you're probably going to have a little bit higher turnovers. You know, we had one game this year where we had 18 turnovers, but we still won. And it's because of how good our defense was. And that's not something that I would like to tempt fate with too often.
Right.
But it did help us. And really, when I look at turnover percentage, I kind of look at the opposite. Really, I look at how I can affect that with the other team, what I can do to really mess them up. I try not to micromanage our offense too much, because I do try to micromanage our defense a lot. And so I don't feel like you can micromanage every aspect of the game. That's not the way the game was meant to be played. And so if they do their work on defense, they really have a lot of freedom on offense. And so when you have a lot of freedom and you're making a lot of reads and you don't have things prescribed for you, you do tend to make a few more turnovers. So for me personally, I don't focus on our turnovers. I do focus on it, and it does stress me out, but I really focus on how we can create more turnovers than how people are turning us over.
And, you know, and with your pace of play, 18 turnovers, I mean, you may have had how many possessions in that game? I mean, how many possessions, you know, right offhand that you guys averaged in a game?
It's not unusual for us to have, you know, well over 100, 130, something like that. And, you know, and there's a few games where it's higher than that. And so that's two or three possessions, at least a minute. And, you know, if you break that down, you know, how many possessions you get per 40 minutes, if you have three times 40 minutes, that's 120. And so if you're at 120, 130, that's a lot.
Yeah.
That's
and
a
that
lot
turnover,
of possessions.
Yeah. And let's say you had 120 turnovers. That would be my middle school teams I used to coach. Let's say I had 120 possessions and 18 turnovers. That's still about a 14% turnover rate, give or take,
right,
which, you know, isn't. Most coaches would lay their head on their pillow at night with pretty good with a 14% turnover rate. So as you communicate and talk about turnovers with your team, like, how do you talk about turnovers with your team? Because obviously it's one of your big four you focus on, but how do you emphasize it outside of just saying, you know, don't do it? I mean, obviously you give guys so much freedom on offense. You play a more open style, decision-based. So there's going to be more potential turnovers in that style of play. So how do you balance the two?
Well, you know, we are at the college level, but again, I would say I did the same thing in high school with huddle. It is really easy to go to each player, you know, especially if you have huddle assist, and just click on all their possessions. And so I can click on each one of my players' offensive possessions from any game or any practice that we chart, and I can just watch. And when you do that, and you're basically looking, you know, you could look at 50 clips in, you know, basically 10 minutes. You can see tendencies over the past 10 games, and you can see where they. I would encourage coaches to do that, especially in the off season. It's just really eye opening When you're able to have an individual film session like that, obviously with Huddle, I can send them if we're not able to meet in person, but I feel like it's more effective to meet in person because you can ask a lot of questions. I always feel like asking questions is yes. better than making statements. And if I can sit there and just ask probing questions to get the answer that I want, but to have them come up with that, they start thinking through. And so turnovers happen either because of in my mind, maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but either there's a mental reason or there's a physical reason. A physical reason, would be they travel, they're constantly off balance. Maybe they're not coordinated enough yet. But a mental reason may be that they're handling the ball in the part of the court where they shouldn't be.
Right.
So I'll just talk about us real quick. One of the main ways we turn the ball over when we're turning it over is driving too deep and not driving. We're trying to drive double or triple gaps. And when they drive those single gaps, an off-ball defender is able to get a hand in there, poke it away. That's probably 90% of the way that we get turnovers is just simply that aspect right there. And so that's fairly easy to fix. And you can easily fix it with film. I try to fix it in practice, but I also don't want to stop practice all the time. And so a lot of times I'll just keep practice going and I'll get a lot of film of what they're doing. And I'll try to create situations where they tend to make turnovers. And then we have either a team film session, but usually more effectively an individual film session. And that can be on my iPad or on my iPhone.
Yeah.
5 minutes before practice, it doesn't have to be a big deal.
Well, what I love, and again, Huddle Sis, I hope you're listening, is if I have a kid, like I had two twin brothers last year that pretty much split minutes. They were both my point guards, pretty even statistically. But let's say one had four turnovers in a game or five turnovers, they do it in 7 second clips. So I could pull the kid in between class at a 5 minute break, and in 90 seconds, I can show him the turnovers really quick. I can shoot them to him on his phone, and then we can also have a little conversation. So that's what I like about having these really long sessions about it. You can do it in a 4 to 5 minute meeting and see that, and also say, hey, you know what? I see what you were seeing there. I get it, because not every turnover, and again, coach may disagree, is not a bad turnover. Like sometimes the defense makes a great play, you made the right decision, and you can also look at those, or you can clean up footwork on, travels that happen frequently and talk about pivoting. So yeah, that's what I appreciate about just the short film sessions with guys one-on-one. And also you're not always blowing them up in a meeting either with the whole team. It's just a one-on-one conversation with a staff member and, just having a conversation about things. So again, turnover percentage, I think. And again, guys, I'm going to post a article to the pod notes that talk about and break down statistically how they rank this. So you play a lot of guys, I'm assuming. You play quite a few players in your style of play, correct?
Yeah, it's not unusual when we're playing games at our level for 10 or 12 guys to play. I do have a group of eight that gets the most playing time, but I try my best to get everyone or almost everyone in the first half. And then really whoever's playing well, going back to the effective field goal percentage, we also do lineup efficiency and we do plus minus lineups. And if a certain lineup is playing well together, we'll ride that horse until that horse is tired. And then we'll change what we do.
Are your staff members or managers or keeping things on the bench so at halftime you can know what's going on with these four factors, or how detailed are you getting with this in the game?
At our level, we get an updated stat sheet at the media timeout, and really most timeouts except for 30 second timeouts we don't, but at full timeouts or media timeouts we do get that. And so I'll take a quick glance again. My assistant coach Miller looks at what we're doing offensively. I look at exactly the opposite, what we're doing to affect their four factors. And I look at it from a defensive perspective. We don't tend to spend a whole lot of time during the timeout with that, unless, again, a media timeout is pretty long. And so Yeah. Media timeout, I usually let them get a drink. They talk amongst themselves. We may look at one thing really quick and then go address that one thing. But we would never address all four things at any one time. We would address just the most important thing in a timeout.
Right. And again, certain players may get more emphasis on one of the factors than others, for example. Well, let's talk about offensive rebound percentage. This is something I really paid attention to this year. What is your goal for offensive rebounding percentage? Because a lot of coaches say 30 to 35%. You know, you're pretty much getting one out of every three misses.
Right.
That's what a lot of people say, except for the guys who like system style basketball. But again, like you said, you play a lot of D1s, you play a lot of other higher level opponents. You may be realistic and be like, you know what, against this opponent, we need a 35%. But if we're playing the Citadel, for example, or Wofford or Furman, we may not get 33%. Coaches, I want to talk to you for just a second about why you should seriously consider getting a Dr. Dish. First of all, their payment plan system is unreal. 12 months, no interest. I paid half up front, and then I paid the other half over the next 365 days, and I have a brand new Dr. Dish CT. On top of that, it's just the best shooting machine out there. The CT is so user-friendly, as are all their shooting machines. So reach out to Dr. Dish. Tell them you heard about them on the United Basketball and Leadership Podcast. Reach out to Dr. Dish. Follow them on all social media at Dr. Dish B-Ball. Now back to our guest.
No, and really, you know, we've looked at tagging up system. We've looked at a couple different things. We've tried a couple different things. Again, when we're playing above our level, which is half of our games, we're only allowed to play 25 games at our level. And you know, 13 of our games are going to be in conference. And so 12 of our games are going to be against tougher competition. And so what we've chosen to do, which I really think works well for whoever we play, is to set our transition defense. We focus more on the transition defense aspect of it and not as much on the offensive rebounding aspect of it. We would rather the other team have to go against our five than us send. And we do send two to the board. We send three back. And we always know who that is. It's, again, if we're going to go Mike Neighbors, it would be our dragon and it would be our rabbit. If you go with that for most of you, that would be your four and your five. That is who we send to the boards, and we send three back. And so that'll probably segue me into a drill that we use. I'll go ahead and talk about that real quick. That kind of works on all of these. There's two drills that I use. The first one I call free throw perfection. And so for them to get a point, they have to score 3 points to win the game. And for them to score 1 point, they have to make two free throws, successfully defend in transition, and then they have to come back and run our offensive set without a turnover. They don't have to make it, but they have to run our offensive set to my liking, where it touched three sides. We got a good shot. And if they do those three things, they get a point. And so that's building the four factors into a game that they love to play. And it just builds that concentration. That is what wins games. And the other drill, which is probably my personal favorite drill, is the pride drill. And the pride drill, they have to, for three straight minutes, play transition defense to my liking. And they've got to be perfect with it. That means they've got to contest. Nobody gets 2 feet into the lane with the ball in scoring position. You know, somebody could even make a shot, but if we did everything perfectly, that's really all I care about is the process. And so if they get down under a minute, let's say they're at 3 minutes to start off with. And they've defended four straight times, which is probably only 40 seconds have come off the clock. If they mess up, it goes back up to 3 minutes. And so they've got to do it perfectly for 3 minutes. If they get it under a minute, so they've got it a minute 59, and then they mess up at a minute 36, and it'll only go back up to 2 minutes. And they don't love it, but I guarantee you that makes practice a lot harder than any, they never have to defend that many times perfectly in a game. And So we keep track of that. We call, you know, we people call it different things, but three stops in a row for us is a kill. And if you go to any of our games, watch any of our games on film, we post K's behind our bench. And that's something our bench is absolutely sold out on. They will hold up fingers for how many stops we have. And when we get that third kill, you'll see our bench and our fans go absolutely crazy at home or on the road. And so that's something we take pride in. You know, Clemson, when they do different things, they put a tombstone in their, they've got a little graveyard behind their football stadium, and they put a tombstone for key victories. And that's kind of the idea that we have there. We make a big deal about it in our team room about if we get 7 kills in a game, we win. I think it's 96% of our games. Wow. If you're able to have 7 times in a game where you get 3 straight stops in a row, there's not too many games you're going to lose with a defensive effort like that.
Now, on the pride drill, just a question about that. So let's say you're doing white versus blue, for example. Are you just focusing on the white team or one of the teams? Or is it both teams? So either team can start the clock over if they don't do it correctly.
So I would just focus on the white team.
Okay.
And so I would do the circle the wagons, and the people who I have as my rebounders are always going to be the 2 guys who are doing the circle the wagons with the 5 guys down on one end. And so they're throwing the ball off the backboard. They're just continuing to circle. And as soon as I blow my whistle, whoever's there gets it. And so that makes it where, you know, it's random. Whoever's getting the rebound, who's getting the outlet, it's random where our 2 guys are going to be on defense. You know, it gives them a whole lot of different things to focus on. And so they go back down. Again, if we're able to stop their initial thrust, which if you break down for us, the shot clock's 30 seconds, the first 10 seconds we consider to be transition. And if they haven't been able to do something productive in the first 10 seconds, then I just blow the whistle. That's really a successful possession for me.
Yeah.
And so I would take it down to about the 250 mark. And then we would just go again at that basket, and white stays on. Now white is able to, they have, you know, our practices, we have 14 people. So there are 2 white subs. And so it's not necessarily all of them on for the entire 3 minutes, but you better believe if that sub comes in and he's the one that makes a mistake, you better believe he hears about it. And that's a good thing to have peer pressure. That increases the communication. There's no way that somebody's going to come in and not communicate because they're going to have all 4 guys all over them. And I don't even have to talk about communication. It's just something that they naturally do because they don't want to. That drill I set for 10 minutes, but I have had that drill go on. One time we had to go on for almost an hour because White just refused to play. It was a Saturday morning practice. And I said, guys, we don't have class. We don't have anything. We are going to do this. That's why it's called the pride drill. We are going to leave here with some sense of pride or, you know, we're not going to leave until we get this done. And so they got it done, and, you know, it only has to happen once and really in their entire career, and it never happens again.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. I like both those drills you talked about. Let's move on to free throw factors.
Okay.
And based on what you talked about with offensive rebounds, I get the feeling that you pay attention to the other team's 4 factors, what they do against you, as much as you do your own.
I do.
Because, for example, like obviously the offensive rebound percentage, well, if I'm sending 2 back, or do you say you send 3 back and 2 crash?
I send 2 to crash and I send 3 back.
Yeah.
And so we basically form sending a triangle in the back.
Yeah. So if another team is sending 3 or sometimes even 4, realistically, you know, you may lose that percentage potentially, but you may be okay with that. Like you're not just weighing the 4 factors against the 4 factors, style of play, everything comes into play.
Correct.
All right. On the free throw factor. And again, in Georgia, you know, free throw factors these last 2 years, because, you know, changed a little bit just because we start the bonus and all that changed. So we started over the bonus after each quarter. Now the 5th foul was single bonus, 7th foul was double. And then at the end of first quarter, it started over again. So the days of getting in the, yeah. So like you know, we would play a team from Tennessee. They'd come over to Georgia and play us. And, you know, they're like, oh man, we're in the bonus with 7 minutes into the first quarter. We've got the whole second quarter. No, it starts over. So we shot more free throws than our opponents, and our free throw percentage was pretty good. But the days I felt like of getting, you know, 25, 26 free throws a game was tough just because the bonus started over after the first quarter and after the third quarter as well. So anyway, that's how we kind of changed our style of play in Georgia. But talk about your free throw factor and what you look for and what percentage you like.
We like to be at 80%, and I can't even tell you how many different free throw games I have. I think I just try to intersperse them in practice. Our game day shoot arounds, we do a different version of them, but
give us a couple that your kids love. Give us a couple of the free throw competitions that your kids love.
So something I got from, I believe it was Steph Curry. I give him the credit for it. It may not be him, but just 30-second free throws. We believe that you can't mess your free throw shot up a whole lot. If you just imagine you're standing at the free throw line and you've got the ball up by your chin, you know, all that stuff before, people like to do all sorts of crazy stuff before their free throws. And all of our players shoot their free throws the same way, as far as they don't shoot. A lot of people, you know, will spin it, they'll catch it, and then they'll go from the waist up to shoot their free throw. And we believe there's a lot of moving parts and a lot that can go wrong. And so we have you get it up to your chin and just basically shoot from chin level up there. And so 30-second free throws, I'll just yell that at any point in practice. They'll all go to have a basket and a ball, and they'll each go to their own basket. And we'll chart 30-second free throws. They're usually able to get 10 free throws up in 30 seconds. It'll be just after we did something. And then the next player will go 30 seconds, and then they'll go report their score to the manager. And so we're able to accurately keep free throw stats throughout practice that way. If we've gone really hard, I will extend that, and I won't do 30-second free throws. I'll say maybe partners go to a basket. Who can get the longest made streak between, so each basket counts, and so you and your partner have to have the longest made streak. Or some days I want to be more of a jerk, and we'll have to do how many you swished in a row. And so longest string together, swish in a row. Day of a game, we may, or the day before a game, right at the halftime of practice, sometimes I might want to change the tenor of practice. I want it to seem more like a game. And so I'll take a 10-minute halftime at practice, and they'll split up. And each basket is shooting with the five guys on it. And every time we make it, it's +1. Every time we miss it, it's +2 for whatever opponent we're going to play the next night. And that opponent's up on the scoreboard. Once it gets to 75, once the opponent gets to 75, each time we miss it, it's actually worth 3 for the opponent. And so it means more the closer that you get. And so those are just a couple. I do a lot of different things, but it's made us be really good free throw shooters. We won probably 10 games this year where it got down to single digits. And it was because of how well we shot our free throws in crunch time.
So back to the free throw routine. Yeah. So when the official throws the ball back to your player, they just gather the ball. They're dipped with their knees. Their knees are bent. They go straight to the chin, or do they take a dribble, two dribbles, or is it straight to the chin?
I don't mind if they take their dribbles, but I don't want them to shoot it the from ball anywhere up to their chin. And so they hold it up, and they're basically, it's just one motion from that point. Instead of having a two motion shot, it's just a one motion shot. And I don't proclaim to be a shot doctor, but there's really not a whole lot that can go on if you get the ball centered and then you just go straight from where it's centered in front of the rim. And it's really helped even average free throw shooters become pretty efficient.
Do you allow the players to give a little five in between free throws?
Yes.
Because I remember a coach, I can't remember who it was, spoke at one of the coaching clinics, and he went through and analyzed shooting and how the second free throw was a lot lower percentage than the first. And he analyzed what's the difference, and it was breaking that motion, breaking and then doing the five. So he stopped his team from doing that, not out of a sportsmanship thing, yeah. But he was thinking, what is the one thing we're doing different from the first free throw, from the second free throw? And he believed that helped raise it a little bit. But anyway, so yeah, coaches are always looking for free throw. You know, we do a variety of things at practice, but we just like to, you know, have a game. We love to play free throw golf throughout, yeah. Where, you know, a swish or the back of the rim make for us is a birdie, hit the rim, make it, it's a par, and you miss, it's a bogey. And we'll just break practice and say, play nine holes of free throw golf. And sometimes the coaches jump in, and that's a fun one. But yeah, I think that the one thing coaches are always looking for is how to make the free throw situation mentally like the game, right. You know, and you mentioned some things there, and I know coaches that play crazy music. I know coaches who have everybody yell and scream like the fans, you know,
another thing we do is, you know, especially when they've had to do something tough defensively, if we play that kill drill where they just had to get three stops in a row, or even this pride drill that I'm talking about, they have to end the drill, and I will choose who's the free throw shooter, and they have to make their two shots. And if they miss, then they have to go back, and we have to go all over again. And you obviously can't do that in all of your practices. But I think when you're in a stretch where you're not playing a whole lot of games, or you've got a couple of days in between games, I think those are good things to do. I think that makes it more game-like. Why did we just do all this work? And then really the easiest part of all this work should be the free throw. And that ends up being the thing that we don't do very well. And so I think that's another really good thing, is to validate your whatever you're doing by having somebody. Sometimes I'll let the captain of the other team choose who should be free throw shooting on the other team. And if he chooses and they make it, then I make that captain do something silly. So it's all good natured, but I think that's good. And it kind of lets them know what their teammates think of them as a free throw shooter. If your teammates think you're a weak free throw shooter, your teammates said it. I didn't.
Absolutely. Yeah. You want to know what your teammates think of you? Just have them pick. Hey, like we do this every walkthrough we end with this. We call it, we break up into white and blue or whatnot, shirts and skins, whatever we're doing at the time. And we call it 555. So you and your group are in one end of the corner of the floor. We're on one end, and you've got to make five threes from all five spots on both ends of the floor. Yeah. So you pretty much have to make 50 threes. But I let the guys pick. I'll pick two random guys to pick. And you think you're a good three-point shooter. You're like, 11 guys just got picked over me. But just something fun like that, and with some free throw golf.
Yeah, your approach there is right. You know, with all of these, I've looked at them from a defensive perspective. What is causing our opponent to be able to shoot more free throws than us? What are we doing? And so really, I ref a lot in practice, and I'll say it one time and I really won't go much after that. But if it even looks like it, if they're reaching or if they're doing something stupid, I'm a tougher ref in practice and what they would view as a bad ref. But, you know, one of the things that drives me crazy is when people try to block a 3-point shot, you know, and so yep. If they even go near somebody, I'm going to call that a foul in practice, and they don't like it, but I get a chance to see how they respond to a referee. You know, and I tell them I'm going to intentionally call things bad, because you just need to be mentally tough and move on to the next play. You can't keep focus on the referee call. And you know, what happens a lot, especially in high school, is one call, one thing like that turns into another bad play. And that could lead to even more free throws by the other team. I mean, how many kids give frustration fouls? And so I look at all those things and try to just, if those are what's causing the opponent to shoot more free throws than us, then I better be doing stuff in practice to address that. And like you, I've seen a really big turnaround. And again, we probably don't make more than our opponent on most nights, but most nights we do shoot more.
So any last words about the four factors, or a coach who's listening is like, you know, I've seen the four factors, they pop up on my huddle, or I've heard people talk about them. Like, where would you tell the coach who's the high school coach or maybe middle school coach to even start? Maybe obviously field goal percentage probably the most important, but what would you say, just take a small bite of the four factors?
Well, with a lot of things in basketball, I would say probably everything in basketball, I have really tried to begin with the end in mind. And so the end, even that can mean different things. What do you want the end of your season to look like? Mm-hmm. What do you want the end product to look like? Even if the end product is the first day of practice, what product do you want? Because I think all coaches see things that they like from other high schools, other colleges, whatever. They see things that they like, and then they have to have a realistic view of what version of that can work for their team. And then work back from there on how you're going to do that. And so, again, going back to our offense, and you've said before that you run things that are similar, all of our skill development is aspects of our offense. And so it's not like we're working on any drill that is anything that we do, whether it's stops and starts, any of our finishes, pivoting, mm-hmm. all of that is just a microcosm of our offense. And so I don't know of another way to do it. That's almost always the way that I've coached. And I think if you can have a lot of efficiency in your footwork, I think your footwork drives everything else. It lowers the turnovers. Good footwork gives you a chance to be more successful with your shooting. I cannot emphasize footwork enough. And, you know, I was going to talk a little bit about our postseason evaluations, because we're getting ready to do those. If you'll allow me to do that, we use, there's a lot that we do. I could probably do another whole podcast on that, but there's, 150, 25, what's the way I just phrased it to them. I talked about it after our last game is what we're asking ourselves right now as coaches, as we prepare for these interviews, is what is the one thing that will get them on the floor and get them more playing time? And so the 100 part of that is 100% of the team would absolutely know next year that that's what you spent your off season doing. Somebody comes back and everybody knows this is what this kid worked on, because realistically, a kid can only get better at one thing. And, I've been a coach there in Georgia, and I know we're usually waiting for football players, but I still think it's possible for somebody playing football to get better, significantly Absolutely. Better at one thing if it's important to them.
Can I ask you something about that?
Yeah, sure.
Just an honest question about it. And I was talking with this coach the other day, because let's say you tell your kids the one thing they need to do to get better, maybe it's 3-point percentage, for example, and they're the second guy on the line, or the third guy in the depth chart, but everyone above them gets a lot better as well, and they may not see their minutes increase as much. How do you deal with a situation like that? Does that make sense? Because I think there's kids I talk to, but I'm like, you're the shooting guard coming off the bench, you're shooting 29%, guy ahead of you shooting 37%, but they both get 4% better, and he's like, well, coach, man, my playing time is, well, because you both got better. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I find that's a rub sometimes in what we tell players.
Well, I think that would be a coach's dream is to have that problem, really.
You know, yeah.
I don't think that problem occurs very often, but I have had that actually. I was fortunate enough to have a exposure to a lot of good coaches there in Atlanta. And, Gene Durden at Buford is an absolute legend. He started Breakfast Club. I went as a very young coach and got a lot of advice from him. I started a Breakfast Club, and I really had kids come work out before breakfast at school, and really just made it part of our culture. And I've done the same thing here. We get our 500 shots in before breakfast here at Bob Jones. And I feel like I'm in there with them. I know what they're doing. And if I ran into that situation, which I did once or twice there in Georgia, is I feel like that's my duty as a coach, is to figure out a way, figure out an offensive plan where I can take advantage of that. And like I said, that's a great problem to have. And that's personally how I would handle it. I would say, if a kid did that work and I asked him to do his work, my job as a coach is to do my work. And if I have that many talented people and good shooters right. on my team, then it's up to me to design a system. And I would design more sets to make sure that kid had an opportunity and was actually game ready. Because you can get better at all those things, but you know, it is possible for not to transfer over to a game. And so I would try to give them a chance to be successful by some sets that I would choose.
Yeah. And I know the example I thought of was like, well, that's a dream scenario, but I'm even thinking of my point guards. I talked to them both about lowering their turnover percentage, right? Because one had a few more turnovers than another. He drops his turnover percentage, but also the other point guard drops his as well. I just think, again, those are rare instances, but Coach and I were talking about this the other day about sometimes it's difficult to tell a kid like this will definitely raise your playing time when you're telling every kid that, for example, you know, and there's only 200 minutes in a game or whatnot, or, you know, I just had that thought recently, and I know it may be rare, but I think it all comes down to how we communicate with kids.
Right. And for me, and again, it would probably be specific to everybody's culture, but for me, all things are relative. If you are significantly better at that, but then the matchup, the guy that you're guarding is scoring as much or more than you, then that kind of cleans the slate for me.
Right.
Defense would always be the determining factor. If I had two guys that had really improved or two guys that were really good and it came down between the two, it would always, who's the better defender?
Oh, absolutely. Especially in that crunch time, and you've got your lineups set by the four factors and your plus minus, that stuff can come into play. That's more important than, you know, scoring is stopping the other team to scoring. So anyway, sorry to interrupt you like that. Oh, go ahead. What you were saying.
So that was 150 is the coach will know you got better. And so again, I think we can only ask them to be significantly better at one thing, but there might be another intangible, such as maybe a quicker release on their shot. Or one intangible I've given recently is when you catch the ball, no negative steps. Don't, if you catch and you land on two, don't backpedal. Don't bring that foot backwards. I call that a negative step. We want to catch and jab. We don't want to catch and go backwards. Or, you know, I've got one guy who every time he catches it, he steps right and then he swings it over to his left. And it's a good move. And it was really good for him in high school, but it's not getting him. He's not creating any advantage here. And so that's something that only him and I would know. And then the 25 is just something that really the player knows. Maybe it is they've got a stronger core. Maybe they've been on the Vertimax and they're more explosive, or they've got a little bit of a higher vertical. Maybe that's something that's just for them. But I do think that that's important, that I've called that different things, but basically if we just have our own little secret, something that is like our secret weapon, something that we know we got better yet at, but only that individual knows that they got better at that. I think that's an important thing too. And people take pride at those type of things. And so I think that our players are better at having a plan when they know that we have a plan. And so, again, that goes to your overall philosophy, but they know what our defensive and our offensive plan is. And so when they know how they fit into that, especially after they've been here their freshman year, I ask them to come in, and we actually jot it down on a 3x5 card, because I want it to be that simple. What do you want out of your year? Show me your plan, and then plan out your 100, plan out your 50, plan out your 25, and just show me what your plan is. And that it really is as simple as having a plan and attacking that plan. And, you know, when I ask them to come up with their own, that gives them some ownership of it. Instead of the coaches making me do this summer, this is my idea for what I can do this summer. And, you know, I can tweak it, but I would rather tweak it then come up with it on my own. You know, I think that just gives them ownership if they plan out what they say that they will do. It's so much better than if it's what we say they should do. So I ask him four questions. Basically, ask their permission. Do you want to be great or do you want to lead? And the second question is, if they say yes, which I've never had anybody say no, I don't want to be great. And number two, are you aware of what goes into it? Number three, are you okay with me holding you accountable? And then number four, here's what I will hold you accountable to and how I will hold you accountable. So do you want to be great? Are you aware what goes into it? Are you okay with me holding you accountable? And here's what I will hold you accountable to and how I will hold you accountable. So again, if it's something that they've given me permission to do, it's more like we're doing this together instead of a boss-employee relationship. It's just two guys on the same bus trying to get to the same destination. And I'm just here to help, man. That's all it is.
So that's good stuff. Anything else about those meetings or that you want to add or how that goes with players?
Well, you know, there's some really impactful questions. You know, there's ideas that I can throw out and I adjust every year. And so some are some things that maybe I'm not doing now that I've done in the past, but you know, some things I ask my seniors are, you know, basically start, stop, continue. What's one thing that we did in this program that needs to be continued? One thing that needs to be stopped? And then can you think of anything we should start doing? Maybe you've heard about other programs doing that. I like to ask it of my seniors because, you know, they have ownership, but they don't have the same investment. They don't necessarily have to face any consequences if they, not that anybody would, but they can feel really free to say, to be really honest with these questions. And the second one is, you know, what's the most impactful thing you experienced while being a part of this program? What would you say to an incoming freshman about what to expect in this program? What's one thing you wish the coaches had known during your time in the program? And if you could do something different in your experience, what would it be? And those have been really valuable. You know, one thing that 100% of my players have talked about is we do a preseason retreat. And, you know, if people are into PGC and Manawatsa likes to talk about this a lot, but that kind of sets the tone for everything that we do, our preseason retreat. And, you know, all of us have different budgets and different ability to do things, but like Mono has a preseason retreat at his house and they just have a night where they get pizza and they talk about things at his house. You don't necessarily have to go somewhere, but we actually go away to a camp for a couple of days and get to enjoy his other company and talk about what we want our culture to be like. That what you just said in our previous conversation was, you know, I call it the end of season awards banquet, and we work back from the, what do you want that awards banquet to be like? Sometimes I go even to a 10-year reunion. What do you envision the 10-year reunion being like? And what do we need to do today to have the 10-year reunion be like that? But if you go to the awards banquet or the last game that you play and you work backwards from that, it's a good visualization exercise. And it's one, I divide my year up into four different 3-month segments. And I take a planning day for each one of those. And those planning days are always related to what we did in those preseason retreats and directly related to these type of conversations. Maybe it's the postseason conversation. I'll take those and I'll plan out what I want to do in the off season right now before they go home for the summer. I'll plan what they're supposed to do in the preseason for next year. And then I'll plan what we do as soon as practice starts based on a lot of the feedback that they give me.
Yeah, no, that's really good. On the questions you mentioned earlier, are players writing this stuff down, or are they just, is this just a conversation?
Yes. I give them a form. You know, we'll talk about, like I said, we'll talk about the 150 and 25, and I want them to come. Some will come prepared for that. Some will not feel comfortable doing that by themselves, particularly the freshmen, because they've never done it before. And so I'll actually go through with them and talk about how to come up with a plan. you know, if you're going to get 100% better at this thing, what's the best way for you to do that? And so that part we'll come up with together in the meeting. And then I'll usually give them those questions that I just asked along with a few more, like maybe offensively, what do you think your greatest opportunity for growth is? Defensively, what's your greatest opportunity for growth? How would you rate your shot selection this year? What was your personal contribution to our culture? You know, because a lot of people can complain about stuff that happens, but I want to know what they did to contribute to it. If you were the head coach, what is one thing you would have done to improve our culture? You know, maybe phrase it that way, where it's not necessarily them, but just putting them in my shoes. And if you were me, what would you do to make our defense better, our offense better, our culture better?
Man, well, Coach, that's really good stuff. Thanks so much for coming on. Again, congrats with the phenomenal season you had at Bob Jones. And again, to listeners, Greenville is a great town. Bob Jones is a beautiful campus. Your facility, do a great job there, you know, with Coach Tony Miller, who's probably already posted about 100 fast models off the Indiana game that's going on right behind me right now. So I have to give him a little shout out there.
That's right. Well, thank you, Matt. I hope everybody takes part in your tournament challenge, getting a chance to win a reservation there in Indiana at the Hoosier Clinic.
That's right.
That's a great opportunity, and I would encourage anybody and everybody to do that.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Coach. And do you want to say anything about the coaching clinic you guys have coming up in Greenville? Do you want to mention anything about that?
Yeah, sure. We do a clinic every year, April 29th and 30th. The 29th, we usually do like classroom sessions. If you've ever been to a PGC, I think it really gives us like an intimate look. I don't think everything at a basketball clinic needs to be on the court and then on. But then on that Saturday, we are on the court. We give whoever our speakers are, we give them a large block of time instead of just 45 minutes. We've got the chairs and the tables around the half court. So you're able to sit right on the court, directly interact with each one of the speakers. And really, I've chosen to have fewer speakers, but really dive in depth to who we have. And so we've always got good speakers, and I would appreciate it. Check it out.
Yeah. Visit this coaching clinic. It's awesome. I can vouch for what these guys do. And, you know, coaches like me and like Coach Miller and other people, we love coaching clinics. I still think they're really relevant. And it's good to, I'm all about the Zoom and all that type of stuff. But it's good to sit with guys shoulder to shoulder and have a conversation with them.
That's right.
All right, Coach. Well, I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir.